This is Susan V. Brock, Telluride Inside and Out. It has been said that more people get their history from this man than from any other source. Ken Burns has been making films for about 40 years now. His documentaries have been honored with dozens of major awards, including 15 Emmys, 2 Grammys, 2 Oscars. And in September 2018, at the News and Documentary Emmys, Burns was honored by the Academy of Television Arts and Sciences with a Lifetime Achievement Award. Ken Burns is also a regular at the Telluride Film Festival, where he's on the Board of Governors, but he comes to Ten annually, 1 week before the gathering of cinephiles, to screen segments from one of his docs, all in support of the Telluride Historical Museum. This year on Sunday, August 25th, An Evening with Ken Burns features a screening of Episode 5, The Rising Road, from Ken's series titled The Roosevelts in Intimate History. The evening also includes a post-screening audience Q&A session, as well as a book and DVD signing presented in conjunction with Between the Covers Bookstore. Ken Burns will be talking that evening about his upcoming series, Country Music, scheduled to premiere on PBS on September 15th. Ken, thanks so much for taking time out of your schedule to talk with me.
It's wonderful to be with you again, Susan, and I only have one amendment that those were Oscar nominations, not wins, so I don't want to guilt my resume at all.
Okay, thank you very much for that clarification. So let's begin with the big picture, so to speak. How would you sum up the meta or the tie that binds your filmography together? The through line that connects baseball to national parks to the Civil War, Vietnam, World War II, jazz, the Roosevelts, the Dust Bowl, Frank Lloyd Wright, and other works in process like the Holocaust and Muhammad Ali, and Hemingway even, to touch upon just a few of the subjects over your 40-plus year career.
I think that the unifying theme, and it's pretty obvious, is that they're all in American history. So when you say World War II, it's actually World War II seen through the lens of 4 geographically distributed American towns. And when you say the Holocaust, it's the very strained and at times dark and controversial story of the U.S. relationship to the Holocaust. That is to say, what did we know and when did we know it? What did we do and what didn't we do? And what sort of contributions did we make to the horrific regime of the National Socialist Party in Nazi Germany? So they're all in American history, and they're all seeking good stories in American history, and that's what I'm drawn to. I don't have a game plan. I just love what I do and want to tell stories in American history.
Thank you for that. For the 6th annual An Evening with Ken Burns, I mentioned before that you will be choosing a sequence from the Roosevelts, namely Episode 5. Why that choice, and does it have anything to do with the following statement from Time magazine? This is the quote: "The Roosevelts is also the story of the 20th century." That may not seem so controversial until you realize how many of today's political arguments are about, essentially, whether the 20th century was a good idea. Limiting the power of corporations, expanding the power of government, creating a social safety net, putting women on a more equal footing with men, ending American isolationism, and becoming vigorously involved overseas. These are political hot buttons today, and they came to us through the Roosevelts. So is the subtext of the Roosevelts all about holding up a mirror to the history happening now, a history in which those issues still have traction?
Well, I think history, whatever moment I've ever done a deep dive in, when I've finished that deep dive, I've come up and been stunned by how much it resonates in the present. You know, we often like to say history repeats itself. It never does. Mark Twain got it better. He is supposed to have said, history doesn't repeat itself, but it rhymes. And I am always quite just stunned and awed by the fact that every time I finish a film, it rhymes. And I chose the Roosevelts because I do think that right now, one of the fundamental questions that we have, and I didn't make the film to score any contemporary political points when I made it. It came out in 2014, and I never make a film to do any of those things. But in retrospect, now that the film's out, and I'm trying to think about what of my work I would like to share in benefit of the museum, it just occurred to me that we are debating these fundamental questions of not just the role of government and isolationism versus a robust connection to the rest of the world, but also how you negotiate hard times, because the Rising Road is about surviving the Depression as much as it is about any particular government program that may or may not still be in place. But so many things that happened in the 1930s under the direction of Franklin Roosevelt's extraordinary administration are with us today, particularly Social Security, labor's right to organize, certainly under threat, but also the Civilian Conservation Corps helped sort of beef up and create the superstructure of a great number of our national parks, which we all enjoy. And chances are, if you're hiking up past Nevada or Vernal Falls in Yosemite, you're hiking on a stone or a wood thing that was first put in place there by the CCC. Lots of what we are today was born in a robust and, for most Americans, welcome interference, if you will, by the federal government in the daily lives of people.
Mm-hmm. So which of the issues that you address in the Roosevelt, in this segment and beyond in any of the seven parts, do you think are relevant for 2020 election as campaign?
Every single one. Obviously, the tension between the haves and the have-nots that runs through the entire 1930s, which this is mainly about. The specter of World War II looms over the very end of the episode, but doesn't quite happen. So it's really Franklin Roosevelt, at his inauguration through sort of to the end of the 30s. Mm-hmm. And so I think that there's not an element today. It's what I just said. Everything. The Bible, Ecclesiastes, said, what has been will be again, what has been done will be done again. There's nothing new under the sun. When we study history, we learn the stories of a particular moment, but we're also given our greatest teacher, which is the fact that those moments also reflect on how we are today in almost every aspect. And so it's not part of my mission initially as a filmmaker, but certainly once the films are out and part of a conversation, I think we can begin to continue that conversation, perhaps deepen it with the resonance that the past provides.
Thank you for that one. Let's look forward now to country music. That's, again, an 8-part, 16-hour series. It's airing on PBS on September 15th. So when did you become interested in making a series about country music and its babies like bluegrass, western swing, and rockabilly? After all, you're a self-professed child of rock and roll.
Well, rock and roll's parents are rhythm and blues and country, so I got to know a little bit about my own interests, parents, and ancestry. I'm looking for good stories. That's it, period, full stop. This is a hell of a good story. I had sort of thought about it intellectually. It had been on lists of, 20 or 30 ideas that you might jot down in a bowl session with colleagues, in the 80s, and then again, I think in either the late 90s or the aughts. In any case, it never had left just the kind of superficiality of my head. But I was with a dear friend in Texas, and he just said, have you ever thought about country music? And it was as if everything went off inside me, in my heart. And I said, yes. And I went back to my colleague and longtime writer and producer, Dayton Duncan. He had it had the same effect. And that was 8.5 years ago, and we've been plowing towards this moment, the broadcast starting on PBS on September 15th and running, for 4 nights the first week and 4 nights the second week and all that stuff. It's as good a story as I've ever come across, and I hope we've done justice to it.
Thank you. I'm sure you have. But it was obviously a gigantic task. You have over 100 interviews, including the likes of Dolly Parton and Vince Gill and Dwight Yoakam and Kris Kristofferson and Willie Nelson and Naomi and Winona Judd. So why so many subjects? And please give a few examples of their most surprising or illuminating or both insights.
Well, this is the way we roll. We had 175 hours of interviews, more than 175 hours of interviews. From those 101 interviews, we've lost 20 of them, by the way, including Merle Haggard and Ralph Stanley and many other people dear to our hearts who had become friends or at least beloved in their contribution to the film. everybody's a surprise. We don't go there saying, can you get us from paragraph 2 to paragraph 3 on page 6 of episode 7? We just talk to them, and we get stuff. And whenever you see a so-called talking head in our film, it's a happy accident of sort of trial and error. Does it fit here? Does it fit there? What's going on? You know, I think everyone was surprising. Dolly was wonderful, and you know, she's so multi-talented. She has one of the greatest voices God has ever bestowed on anyone. She, in addition, is one of the greatest songwriters, belongs in the Mount Rushmore of songwriters, just for Jolene alone, let alone I Will Always Love You. And she's a phenomenal businesswoman and a strong woman, and this is a story surprisingly about strong women from the very beginning, and you don't expect that. Most of the musical genres are very tight fraternities. Jazz would be the most obvious thing where, you know, you might let in an Ella or a Billy, but for the most part, it's a guy's locker room. Country music, at the very beginning, the Carter family, there's Mother Maybelle, the original American guitarist, and there's Sarah Carter, the original sort of keening voice and plaintive voice of country music. And then it just goes through Rose Maddox and Kitty Wells and Patsy Cline, of course, Loretta Lynn, who's singing in the same year that the National Organization for Women is founded and the same year women's liberation enters the lexicon. She's singing. Nobody in rock is singing. Nobody in folk is singing. She's singing Don't Come Home A-Drinkin' With Lovin' On Your Mind. And it just it surprised us all the way through. And we did an interview with Loretta, and she was wonderful addressing it. Now, she wouldn't identify herself as a feminist, nor would her legions of fans, but that doesn't matter if somebody's speaking to you about emotions that you feel. And that's the thing about country music. We imprison it in a kind of superficiality that it has never had and has only added in complexity to. The songwriter Harlan Howard called country music Three Chords and the Truth. Very, very revealing statement. The beginning part acknowledges its relative simplicity in comparison to, say, the sophistication and complexity of classical music and some jazz. But the truth part, it is addressing universal human emotions that every single one of us, regardless of where we come from, regardless of our age, our wealth, our gender, our orientation, our politics, experience. So when Hank Williams say, the silence of a shooting star lights up a purple sky, and as I wonder where you are, I'm so lonesome I could cry. Now, there is no one within the sound of my voice that has not known something exactly like that or akin to that emotion. This is the same man who wrote earlier, I got a hot rod Ford and a $2 bill, and I know a place right over the hill in Hey Good Lookin', which is one of the great songs about the excitement of a new love. And so country music, as much as we try to disguise it and mask it with, you know, hound dogs and pickup trucks and good old boys and six packs of beer, is about 2 4-letter words that most of us find difficulty talking about or confronting in our own lives, and that's love and loss. And I, you know, none of us were prepared for the power of this stuff. It deals with race and the continual African-American influence in country music, and certainly right from the very beginning, the women's story that I described, the tension between commerce and art, the tension between the word and the music itself, the lyric and the melody, all of those things were there, but nothing prepared us for the surprise of the power of the emotions. And once you tell a story, which is the editing of human experience, once you've agreed you're not going to do a telephone book or an encyclopedia, you're going to tell a narrative story, and you get to cut away a lot of the dead wood, and every musical genre has execrable, dumb, stupid stuff, and you get to hear the cream of the crop, suddenly you begin, that power begins to magnify, and we're as excited about this as any project we've done, and can't wait to share it. And I'm a child of rock and roll and R&B, as you say, but now, you know, I'm certainly a country convert.
So in 2001, you came out with Jazz. You know, now it's fast forward close to 20 years and you're doing this country music. In the case of jazz, you tried to define it and I think found that it was like trying to hold on to mercury. How did you and your collaborators, Dayton Duncan and Julie Dunphy, come to define this genre, country music?
You don't.
Okay.
That's the thing. You can't, and we didn't in jazz. We didn't try to in jazz. We tried to put our arm around it and embrace all its variety. And as I said, you know, country music has never been one thing. At its big bang, the recording of first the Carter Family and then a few days later Jimmy Rogers in 1927 in Bristol, Tennessee, is supposed to have set off country music. Well, if you listen to Jimmy Rogers, he sounds nothing like the Carter Family. Jimmy Rogers is Saturday night to their Sunday morning, his dim bar rooms and the rogue and the scamp to their values of home and family and church. And that tension exists in American life. It exists in jazz, it exists in R&B, it exists in all of our so-called native idioms, all of which are themselves a mix. So Jimmy Rogers is totally infused with the blues, and A.P. Carter, the Carter Family, had an African-American mentor, Leslie Riddle, who traveled around with him song-catching, song-collecting in Appalachia. So, you know, he, in fact, there's a really wonderful story in the film. Leslie Riddle takes a hymn, a wonderful gospel stomp called "The World's on Fire," and brings it to the Carter Family. They love the melody. They release it as "Little Darlin' Pal of Mine," which is one of their big, huge hits. Woody Guthrie comes along and says, "Wow, I like that melody. I'm going to write this song called 'This Land Is Your Land.'" All with the same melody, different songs. They're all fantastic, and they begin to tell you that any time you set a border or in silo something, the artists don't care about it. When Ray Charles was given creative control of an album for the first time in his professional life, he recorded, much to the consternation of all of his friends, modern sounds in country and western music. And he had a Hank Williams tune, "Hey, Good Lookin'," but he also had Don Gibson's country tune of a few years before called "I Can't Stop Loving You." And Ray Charles' version of "I Can't Stop Loving You" was the number one song of the summer of 1962. So whatever borders, whatever, you know, however upset we get about Lil Nas X being booted off the country music Billboard charts, it doesn't matter because it's now the number one song ever, and it's a country song, and it's by a gay black rapper. If anybody tries now to put a fence around any kind of music, you know, when Bob Dylan's going to Nashville to do something with his career, with every one of the four Beatles had as their initial entrance into music, country, their interest in music, country music. When you hear Elvis Costello or Paul Simon or Jack White or Wynton Marsalis talk about country music, you realize it's all the same. In fact, Wynton Marsalis in our film on country music, not jazz, he was a major part of that film, but he's a major part of this film, says we all have an ethnic heritage, but we have a human heritage that is much more important, and art tells the tale of us coming together. And that's all it is. It's not about definition. It's about permitting, as we have to do in our own relationships, the fact that sometimes a thing is one thing and the opposite of that thing at the same time.
Yeah.
And that's just life.
I would be remiss not to nod to PBS. Your career twins with that company, which reaches millions of viewers on TV and online. Would you just nod yourself in the direction of PBS and briefly summarize that relationship?
Happily. I none of my films could have been made anywhere but on public broadcasting. Public broadcasting has one foot tentatively in the marketplace and the other proudly out of it. Look, I could go to a streaming service or a premium cable channel and not have to go through the years of fundraising to do the Vietnam War series or this recent country music series, but they would have never allowed me 10 and a half years to do Vietnam or 8.5 years to do country. And that's the difference. They are willing for me to put in my time to do the deepest sort of dive with the best experts and with my talented colleagues and together work out something that has resonance and that also has a subsequent life in repeated viewings. It isn't just skywriting that disappears in with the first wind, with the first breeze, like most broadcast television. It lives in schools and it lives in repeat viewings and it lives in a different sort of place. So I'm happy that they would have me. I'm proud to be a small part of their family. And you're right. They reach millions of people. They're the largest network in the United States, 335 affiliate stations. It reaches into all corners. And for those people who sort of accuse it of some political bias, they're crazy. William F. Buckley's conservative firing line was on PBS for 35 years. And we are actually a bigger force in people's lives in Alaska and Oklahoma and Arkansas and West Virginia because we may be the only signal people get, not just with our superb, I believe, primetime schedule, but with our children's programming and with continuing education and Classroom of the Air and crop reports and weather reports and homeland security things. We are the essential part of people's lives, and maybe more so in the so-called red states. So I reject any sort of political bias on its part. And my films, regardless of whatever my personal politics may be, always make it for everybody. And our ratings speak to the fact that across the board, if you tell a good story, you have the possibility of engaging everyone. The novelist Richard Powers said, "The best arguments in the world won't change a single person's mind. The only thing that can do that is a good story." And I'm just interested in telling good stories. And people change their minds of their own volition, not because someone else is telling them they're wrong.
Finally, you, as I mentioned in the introduction, are a cheerleader for the Telluride Film Festival, and you serve on its Board of Governors. The fact that you come to town 1 week early to support the Telluride Historical Museum is certainly a lucky break for that institution. But what role do you see does the film festival play in your life and in the world of media in general? Do you see the event as an agent for social change or art for art's sake, entertainment pure and simple, or both?
Well, you know, that's a big, complicated question. I quite frankly think the Telluride Film Festival is the best festival on earth, and a lot of it has to do with the fact that you go there as an act of faith. It's hard to get there. It's expensive to do that, and you are trusting in the curation. Every other festival publishes what they're going to show. I've been going, this will be my 30th straight year that I've gone, whether I've shown a film there or not, and I've served for the last 15-plus years as a member of the Board of Governors, and happily so, having nothing to do with the selection of the films they choose. And so you arrive innocent and excited, thrilled to see what they might have, and you spend 3.5 glorious days in dark rooms with strangers in this wonderful communion that is part social change, I suppose, but it's more about the conversation that art creates. In our country music series, Vince Gill, the extraordinary singer-songwriter, says, "At the end of the day, all I ever want for music is to move me." Tolstoy said, "Art is the transfer of emotion from one person to another." Mm-hmm. And so what transpires at Telluride during the film festival is one of the most important parts of my life. We look forward to it, my family, on the calendar, for months at a time, and you come early to help the museum, but you come early so that you can walk and hike and look up and go, oh my God, and then feel like you've soaked up enough of that, never enough, that you can then go into those dark rooms and see the films that you do over the next intense 3.5 days. But if I didn't get my just nature Jones just from being there or seeing friends or having leisurely meals and not just grabbing a diggity dog, I don't know whether I could have sustained the 30 years.
Thank you for that. This has been Susan D. Brock, Telluride Inside and Out. Honored, delighted, as every year, to have been speaking with Ken Burns. The Evening with Ken Burns takes place on behalf of the Telluride Historical Museum on Sunday, August 25th. And it features the screening of Episode 5, The Rising Road, from his series titled The Roosevelts, An Intimate History. Ken, thanks so much for your time.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you, Susan.
You're welcome.